Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Kevin Lindsay here with another episode of Systems and Cybernetics. Continuing along with my recent favorite theme of how to not just tolerate or work begrudgingly within systems, but how we can, as individuals, communities, and organizations, think and act systemically, today I'm excited to welcome my guest, David Ehrlichman, to talk about his 2021 book, Impact Networks, Create Connection, Spark Collaboration, and Catalyze Systemic Change. David is a co-founder and coordinator of Converge, a network of systems strategists, designers, facilitators, educators, and evaluators who partner with people, organizations, and networks to navigate complexity and co-create meaningful change. With his colleagues, he has supported the development of dozens of impact networks, taking action on issues as diverse as economic mobility, environmental stewardship, human rights, and healthcare reform. You can find Converge at converge.net or from my link in the show notes. Prior to catalyzing Converge, David was a consultant with Monitor Institute, where he was first introduced to the power of networks. He lives near Seattle, Washington, in the ancestral territory of the Coast Salish peoples. And when he's not writing or working with networks, you can usually find him spending time with family and friends out in nature or playing music. He lives with his wife, two goofy dogs, and a baby daughter. Welcome, David, and thank you very much for joining me here on the New Books Network.
Thanks. Great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
My pleasure. So your book was recommended to me by a friend whose work is focused on convening regenerative spaces. And she thought I'd be interested in talking to you as she felt your work is heavily influenced by systems thinking. And she's quite right. I read the book, loved it, and just felt like it was a really meaty systems conversation that we could have. I'd like to start our conversation by hearing a little bit about your background and your relationship with systems thinking, if you wouldn't mind starting there.
Yeah, of course. Happy to. Yeah, my journey in this work starts really about 15 years ago. I'd worked in a number of different places as a server at a restaurant, in a big corporation, in a small tech startup, and at a nonprofit organization. And by that time, I knew that my work was going to be for purpose, for impact of some kind. I didn't know how I could really contribute, what my path would be. So I was working at this nonprofit organization, and I saw how they were doing really great, inspiring work. But they were really, in a lot of ways, felt like they were addressing the symptoms of this massive broken system. They were addressing issues around affordable housing, but also really kind of operating alone as an organization. I didn't see much collaboration with so many of the other types of organizations or public agencies or others who were working on that big complex issue. So I started getting really curious about how we could work not just within a single organization, but really across organizations at a systems level. That was really the guiding question that led me to then Monitor Institute, and that's the social sector wing of a consulting firm. And it was there that, you know, had the opportunity to get exposed to early writings from June Holly and Valdis Krebs, Madeline Taylor and Peter Plastrick, and to get exposed to systems thinking and systems mapping and learn more about deliberate approaches to multi-stakeholder collaboration that were really processes and tools we could use to bring people and bring organizations together to do things together they can't do alone. And that it was, you know, we could build on lessons from social movements and community building and community organizing, and then also bring in new lessons from network science and systems thinking and others to really collaborate at larger scales than I had seen before. And notice too how, you know, some individual organizations were really scaling their impact out, increasing their connections and through collaboration rather than scaling up, building a bigger and bigger organization. Kaboom is an example. They help build playgrounds in low-income neighborhoods, and they don't have a huge organization. Really, instead, they partner with local organizations who are on the ground in those neighborhoods to support them and their communities to do the work that's necessary to build the playground. So really scaling out instead of scaling up. That was really intriguing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And also noticing networks that were really deliberately organized and even staffed to support coordination and collaboration across systems. REAMP was an early example, started in 2005. They brought together over 150 different organizations to equitably reduce carbon emissions across 9 states in the Midwestern United States. And I've had really big success stories since 2005 in terms of shutting down coal plants, passing energy efficiency policies, and so forth. And so that was kind of the light bulb moment for me, that it was possible to work across the silos we create and the boundaries that we often impose on ourselves through different organizations and different systems. And so, long story short, that led me to Fresno to help start a network there to revitalize that city, cross-sector network. Then the Santa Cruz Mountains region, a network for environmental stewardship, and launched Converge in 2013. And since then, I've really just been supporting networks in a really wide variety of fields and all around the world. And from those experiences, seeing every network is really so different in terms of the historical context and the context of the place and the people who are involved. But there's also a lot that's similar in terms of, it's often how they begin and the type of leadership that's required, mm-hmm. and the processes and structures they use to form and grow. And it was those common patterns that then informed the book and that we've been trying to share with others.
Got it. And I noticed just a lot of the thinkers you reference in the book. I felt a connection really when I was reading the book, just because of so many of your influences. Capra, Meadows, Sharmer, we covered a lot of these thinkers on this channel. And so are there any in particular that just really stood out for you along the way as kind of big influencers, just something you just really resonated with from their work?
Yeah, you mentioned Meadows, and I'd have to say Danilo Meadows, you know, the places to intervene in a system was really sort of mind-blowing at me at that moment. Mm-hmm. It was really influential, and especially, you know, first of all, understanding the concept of leverage points and how shifting one thing can produce big changes throughout the system. But the biggest moment for me was where she got to, you know, the power to change paradigms and then to transcend paradigms altogether. And what that meant in terms of, you know, our mental models as individuals and our collective mental models, and how we can change the way that we understand the systems around us and interact with them. That was a big deal for me.
Got it. Yeah, for me too. So I really appreciated running across her in your book. Of course, her work just lives on, of course, and I think will always be really relevant. For the listeners on this channel, systems thinking, cybernetics, all the concepts, some of the thinkers and writers that go back, you know, even a century, are really familiar. But I think it might be useful for you to just kind of talk a little bit about the relationship between systems and networks. I've read the whole book. Listeners haven't, I'm going to presume, have not had that benefit when they listen to this. So I feel like I get it. But it would be really helpful, I think. You write at one point that networks underlie systems, and whether those systems are organizational, social, planetary, and they have a big influence on how healthy and effective those systems are. So what came to mind for me is, and they can, you can also have, I guess, really unhealthy networks that, and you talked about echo chambers as well. So I'd love you to just kind of spend a little bit of time talking about that relationship between systems and networks.
Yeah, of course. I think we know that we live in this world of great complexity, and that complexity just seems to increase rapidly. And we know we have to work together in pretty unprecedented ways, because addressing big complex issues like social inequities and climate change and providing economic opportunity for all, these aren't issues that can be solved by working alone. Right? To address, these are really systemic issues, and to address systemic issues, we also have to work systemically. And what I mean by that is working not just within kind of one piece of the system, but really across the whole system. And that means that it spans multiple organizations and multiple sectors, that there's no single organization or institution who can change systems by themselves. And it's because, systems are complex, and complex issues are experienced really differently by different people. People are affected by these issues in really different ways. The system is constantly changing and evolving. And so in our work to address complex issues and work in complex systems, it's not something that we can plan out in advance. We're not building a bridge from point A to point B. It's not always clear how one action is going to kind of affect the system in a bunch of different ways. And there's no single person or organization who can hold all the complexity by themselves. We each have our piece of the puzzle. But instead, we really need to bring different actors together from across these systems who are seeing different parts of it, bringing their different diverse perspectives, strengthening their collective ability to share information, resources, building on the things that are already working, learning from the things that aren't working, but then, to use back to Donella Meadows' work, finding those leverage points, the places where a collective concerted effort could really have tremendous impacts across the system, because there are certain factors that are more influential positively or negatively than others, and kind of have ripple effects like that. So in our work within complex systems, it's really about how can we strengthen the connections, the flows of information and resources, and from that can kind of learn into and discover together what we can do together to shift the system in a positive direction.
About a year and a half ago, I had an opportunity to talk to Ray Eisen and Ed Straw about the hidden power of systems thinking. And I really appreciated a few things in particular in the book. And one of them was just a systems sensibility, and how important it is for us to have that systems sensibility. And when I read the part in your book about the need for adopting a network mindset, it felt like that it was taking that systems sensibility to that next level. And, the comparison you made between the hierarchical mindset versus the network mindset really, I felt, kind of brought that to life. So is that kind of your intention for when you think about network mindset? It's how do you actually embody or enable within ourselves that ability, that sensibility those guys are maybe talking about?
Yeah, I think it's so many of us, speaking for myself at least, socialized in hierarchical systems my whole life, and from schools and college, and then most of the places that I worked, there was always a boss and chains of command and this rigid organizational structure that really was imposed from above and dictated the path of information and flow of resources. And a lot of things in life, of course, are organized in that tree-like structure, but networks are really kind of underlie even hierarchical structures. In any hierarchical system, there's always these informal networks of people, of connections, of information flow that is actually getting things done in really different ways than the org chart would show. The shift is to recognize that, you know, we're not the center of the universe, and our organization isn't the center of the universe. It's really kind of one star in this large and diverse constellation of others, right? So it's really common for organizations to put their own status and growth at the center of their focus. It makes a lot of sense. Organizations are really pressured to you know, show their impacts or their continued growth. But when it comes to, again, to addressing complexity, there's not any organization who can do it by themselves. So we have to see ourselves as part of this larger, diverse constellation of actors and organizations who touch these issues and are intersecting with these issues in many different ways. And so, you know, can we, instead of always putting the organization's growth or status at the center of our focus, can we put a shared purpose or shared issue at the center of our focus and then work to strengthen those connections and flows between them? And that's really what it means to build a network.
Got it. So thank you for that. That very, very useful context. You know, if you flip over to the back of the book, the very first sentence is, "The social and environmental challenges we face today are complex, systemic, and structural." This is kind of the backdrop, and you've touched on this already. We've got complex, very systemic and structural challenges that we need to address. The premise of your book is that we need a certain kind of network, this impact network, and that's the title of the book. I'd love you to just talk a little bit about what you really mean by impact networks and the different kinds of impact networks that you believe we need.
Sure. I mean, when we're talking about systems and complexity, it all can sound really complex, right? But really, this is all about how can we actually work together better? How can we coordinate our efforts across silos, across the typical boundaries that hold us back? So that's really what it is at a simple level. It's all coordination. And you know, hierarchies have emerged over the past many generations as the dominant organizing structure, because they're predictable, they're really good at doing what they do best. They are really good at producing goods and services, but they're not so good at kind of adapting on the fly. They're not so good at engaging really large numbers of people. They're not so good at being the structure for, you know, multi-stakeholder collaborations where people are coming together to the table as equals for, you know, collective ownership models. And so networks, it's really a return to the way that we've naturally connected with one another for as long as we've been around, right? People have always formed networks. We've always worked in community with others to solve challenges that we can't on our own. And so in many ways, I'm really talking about a return to the ways that humans have naturally connected for generations, right? Really an unlearning of the top-down command and control model that's been imposed on so much of the world. Again, we can build on lessons from social movements and community organizing and indigenous wisdom, and then incorporate lessons from network science in terms of understanding how people actually connect, how behavior changes, how information spreads, and then also bring in new tools and technologies that really allow us to coordinate across time zones and at scales that we previously weren't able to quite as well, to organize in this more decentralized way where leadership is distributed, decision making is distributed. There's not a single authoritative leader, but really multiple network leaders, multiple facilitative leaders or servant leaders, people who are not directing the work and telling people what to do, but really creating the conditions so that people can connect, share information, and find ways to work together on behalf of the common issues that bring them together. So it's really, it's a shift in the way that we're approaching organizing, but in a lot of ways, it's really a return to the ways that we've naturally wanted to connect with one another in relationship and in community.
Yeah. And also, you know, what I picked up from what you wrote, it's not just the way we as human beings have always connected, but this relationship and grounding around living systems. So, you know, when we think about self-organization and systems thinking in cybernetics, and we talk about autopoiesis, and emergence and what we see in the natural world, in terms of relationships, cooperation over competition, but also like those tensions that you refer to, which in the natural world are naturally competitive sometimes. So this notion of the parts and the whole, it being in tension, and how, you know, if you think about most organizations, I'll use that word rather than network, but that's, I think about a company, like the companies that I've worked for my whole career, we don't really like tension, or we might say, like going into a planning process, here are the rules for the meeting. And, you know, we don't want any conflict, but some healthy tension is required, but we don't really do it. It's interesting. But when we think about, for me, this is kind of one of the challenges in system thinking, that the parts and the whole and the relationships between them, and how we think about embracing that tension, working with it, squashing it, like, you know, and then the relationship between that dynamic and emergence, which you also spend a lot of time on in the book. And it's a topic I love. So I'd love it if you could just, that wasn't really a question. It was just kind of a bunch of like notes that I've, or thoughts I've had, reading the book, but I'd love you to just maybe speak to that theme.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's tension in a system, and tension is really healthy, right? If we, it's how we can walk across a rope that's tied between two trees. If it's hot with tension, it has strength. So there is strength in tension, as long as we're able to hold that tension and it doesn't break. In any system, there's going to be, in any human system, I should say, in any organization, any network, any community, there's going to be disagreements about different perspectives, disagreements about the right thing to do. There's always tension and potential conflict there. A lot of times I think we shy away from that and we just want to focus on the places where we agree. But the only way to actually discover the many different things that we do agree on and the slices of common ground that we do have is actually to be able to be open to expressing our full divergent opinions. You know, only through divergence and allowing and discovering the many different perspectives we have, only then can we start to see where there's overlap and begin to converge on those different places where there is common ground. And then can work together on those things, and those things can become sort of a foundation for the development of our relationship and our future collaborative work. And now through that process, we have greater clarity and understanding of where we actually disagree. A lot of times people will just project on others about what they think or the positions they hold. But actually, if we get into the nuance of it, it's a lot more varied than I think we realize. Of course, there's a lot of polarization, but if you dig deep enough, there's actually a lot of common values underneath that. You know, we have a lot of the same whys, even if our hows are really different. And this is why, you know, networks fundamentally are webs of relationships that connect people or things, right? Networks are all around us in that way. And so networks are really as strong as the connections that hold them together, and then the flows that are moving through those connections, flows of information and resources. But that's why building, you know, real human connection, building community, building belonging is so important in these types of, in this type of collaborative work, because there's always going to be disagreements, right? There's always going to be tensions. And actually it's necessary, again, to be able to have divergent opinions and see what's out there. And so if we, though, are able to hold that tension, we can work through those inevitable disagreements and miscommunications that are going to arise at any time that we try to work with another person or another group, and hang in there long enough until we can find that common ground where we do agree to work together on that, or at least have a greater understanding of each other's perspectives, and therefore also a greater understanding of what's actually happening in the system as a whole, and where there might be opportunities to influence it.
I want to mention at this point that throughout the book, you have little symbols that indicate if there is something that readers might want to go to the Converge website and look for. There are a bunch of guides and tools that are part of the Converge Network toolkit. And there's a lot of really useful information that people should look at if they're interested in this. And I bring that up because at this point in the conversation, I feel it's really valuable to talk about the really practical aspects of your work. We're not just talking systems in theory here. You've done a lot of network, impact network work. You've developed a lot of impact networks, I guess is probably the better way to say it. And you've used these tools. So when I think about, for example, like planning for emergence is one that is just a concept that I really like, and what that actually means, and how we can bring a concept like that into our work. A lot of times when you show up for a meeting and you say we actually don't have an agenda, we're going to just kind of work through a process, we're going to see what emerges, that makes people kind of squeamish, because it feels, well, are we going to walk away with anything here? Are we actually going to make any progress? Are we productive? You know, time's ticking. I've only got so much time set aside for this meeting. Is that? Do you think that is one of the biggest challenges in this work?
I think it's that's one of the tensions is between planning and emergence. And in work, when we are engaging with complexity, where there is not a very clear beginning or end, we can't predefine a blueprint to go from point A to point B. We have to sit in the unknown, the unknowing, and that's really hard. And that creates a lot of tension for people who want to, you know, get things done and want to have a lot of certainty. Ambiguity is hard for people in general. But what we can do, we don't just need to get in the room and just be totally loose and emergent and we'll figure it out. We can actually create deliberate processes that we know are going to move us in a positive direction, and let the results of that still be emergent. We don't need to hold on too tightly to what we are trying to make happen or what we think might happen, because we just don't know until we start and we learn and we adapt and we adjust. And we can create deliberate processes for emergent results. And that's really what this book is all about. It's this book is not theoretical. It's really just built through practice, through the 50 plus impact networks that we've worked with, through the 40 something interviews I did with network leaders who have been doing this work for a really long time. This is really not a theoretical work. It's actually practical work of how can you, we know we can increase connectivity, increase flows of information and communication, and increase instances where people find opportunities to collaborate with one another. We know we can do that in a pretty predictable way. We can measure that using social network analysis. We don't know exactly what those collaborations are going to be or what's going to kind of pop out of that. Once we go through those deliberate processes, then people have a better understanding of what's happening across the system, where there might be opportunities to act. Then they identify more specific measurable things that they can go after. And that's when we can then introduce those more tangible metrics in terms of how we're going to measure the impact of our work. But until that point, rather than holding on to that potential future state too tightly, because we just honestly don't know, instead we can create, again, a really deliberate process to bring groups together to then get to those points where we can create more intentional and sometimes hierarchical structures to then execute on the project work.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Got it. That's very, very useful. And as I was reading and listening to you just now, I can't help but think about some projects that are going on where I am right now on Vancouver Island. And I think listeners know that I'm based in the San Francisco Bay Area, but I've often mentioned Vancouver Island, a place I really care about. I'm actually also kind of sitting on the ancestral land of the Coast Salish people, specifically the Shnunaymuk First Nation. And there's a lot of work that's happening between different parts of the community, including the First Nation community here. And I don't know how to describe it. It's a little bit of a cart before the horse kind of thing, or, you know, kind of trying to identify that outcome, which is, you know, often really important. We've got urgent things around climate, carbon emissions, all these kinds of things. And there's urgency. And I hear from a lot of members of the community, this is all great. You know, becoming a transition town is awesome, building community, but what are we doing now? What's the action we're actually taking? And so it feels like this is a necessary kind of process that needs some investment of time. I can really hear that from you. And I can see that would be part of the resistance as well, kind of given there are a lot of people who are invested and then many who aren't necessarily invested in change, but a process like this could be really helpful for getting that kind of alignment and commitment and real kind of love kind of feeling into that. I'm using kind of wishy-washy words, you know, those warm and fuzzy kinds of words. But I think that's often a neglected part of process and facilitation.
And what we can do, though, also is we can very quickly and immediately build on the things that are already happening. We can coordinate the efforts that are already underway. We coordinate our existing actions. And that requires having greater understanding of what each person is working on, what they care about, where there might be intersections in terms of focus on place or issue between folks. But we can, and we always do at when we bring people together for these networks, we are building sort of the foundational infrastructure for longer term work together and longer term work to address the system as a whole. And that is long term work. But then also really immediately can understand what are people's immediate needs. What do you need to get out of this to make it work for you or your organization or your constituents? What requests do you have in this moment? A lot of folks need a conference room to do X, Y, and Z, or resources on an issue that they're working on, or to talk with somebody who has experience on a similar project, or whatever it might be. We can introduce those immediate requests, and then also have space for people to support those and to make offers. Here's something that I can give to the collective to make it work for others. Mm-hmm. So we're really deliberate about gives and gets. What can you give? What do you need to get out of it? And so we're strengthening the things that are already happening, and we're really we want to make sure that people are also getting value, direct value, out of their time committed to these different networks and engagements in the short term as we move along the path of longer term work together. Mm-hmm. So I think you can do both. That's both, again, another tension between the long term interests that we have and the short term needs.
Nice. Part two of the book delves into cultivating these impact networks. And there's some great guidance in there. And I love that you start, and you've just touched on this a moment ago, starting with making sense of the system and building on what already exists. So making sense of the system, you draw again on Donnell and Meadows and talk about leverage points there and how useful that is in terms of making sense of the system. And then building on what already exists, I think that is and your explanation right now is really valuable too, because I think that's part of what I quite often see is people will say, oh, well, that particular organization there is not really meeting our needs completely. We need to go out and start a new one, and we're going to have similar mission with similar goals, but here's our angle, and we need to do it this way. And it kind of feels like, well, while there's room for everybody, and appreciate everybody rolling up their sleeves and doing work together, are we in some ways taking resources away from each other? Are we kind of competing for attention because people can only have so much capacity to pay attention and to, listen to people talk or go to Zoom webinars or give money? And so I really appreciate that that's where impact networks are also really important. Have I got a good read on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was one of the things that led me into this work, is seeing that there are so many different organizations who are working on very similar things, but aren't really actually coordinating with one another. I think the only way to address these big issues is to, yes, do lots of different things, but also make sure that those are reinforcing and learning from one another's failures and successes, right, and sharing information about that. Even if we don't work together, we can strengthen the system as a whole by increasing the flows of information and resources between us in a learning network.
Yeah.
And what you spoke to too made me think of some principles of network mindset from Janeway Skillner, who's been studying collaboratives and networks for over two decades. And she has four principles of network mindset, which number one is mission, not organization, which means focus on scaling your impact rather than growing an individual organization or function. Right? Again, if you put that purpose at the center, if you put the impact at the center, you might recognize that another organization isn't really necessary. How can we actually build on the things that are already happening or partner with others, scaling out rather than scaling up? Second is node, not hub. Understand that we're part of these interconnected systems, not the center of it. Humility, not brand. So how do we share leadership and credit with peers instead of hoarding power or trying to be a hero? And then trust, not control. Really doing this in large part by building trust-based relationships rather than systems of control. And that's often where it starts, finding that ROR, the return on relationships.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. So one of the things I noticed right away in the Cultivating Impact Networks section was your statement that convenings bring the whole system together. And I went, interesting. Quite often I'll be in convenings and we notice, people will notice that there are voices missing from the conversation. And we can sit around and talk about this all day long. And isn't this fantastic? And we end up feeling very positive. And this is great work. We're so committed. And then you feel positive until you realize we're only maybe a small part of this picture. And so this notion of bringing the whole system, convening the whole system, it sounds challenging. I mean, I can see why it's important. And earlier you call out the danger of echo chambers, but we also don't want to replace one echo chamber with another. And so that's obviously why it's important to bring the whole system together. But it's obviously more dangerous, more daunting. It's, I'm guessing, more difficult to get the right people to the table.
Definitely. And it's never something that's complete. You know, you're never, and will never be fully finished. You'll never truly ever bring the whole system together, but it's that aspiration, right? And so constantly asking yourself at that meeting, who else needs to be involved? And then being very deliberate about engaging those folks at the next meeting. And importantly, at that point, not inviting them into your thing, but really inviting them into co-creating what's possible now that they're part of the group. Adrienne Marie Brown talks about who to convene. Number one, those who are directly impacted by the issue. Number two, those who are doing compelling work on the issue. And then number three, those who can move the work forward. So it really is a priority to convene a diverse set of participants from the very beginning, not later after the effort's already been established, because whatever patterns are defined in the early stages of a network's formation or community's formation, whether consciously or subconsciously, they're likely to persist for a while. But of course, a lot of efforts have already gotten started. It's hard to get the whole system in the room from the very beginning, but we're constantly asking ourselves, right, who else? Who else needs to be involved, and how do we really invite them into co-creation then? And that it, you notice it is hard. I think technology allows us to do that in terms of lowering the barrier to entry, in some cases through virtual convenings rather than in person, but there are, you know, accessibility issues around technology as well. So there's always challenges. One of the things though is, this really speaks to how can we bound the issue that we're focused on, bound our purpose more and more tightly around place, issue, population, whatever it might be. Bounding it more tightly makes it that much more easy to find and connect and engage the people who are focused on that particular issue or purpose. When we're trying to, you know, address these massive global issues that are just so hard to get our hands around, you know, almost everybody could be involved. It's so hard to find the commonalities between them. The conversations are much more diffuse. So, you know, we really try to, how can we bound that purpose as tightly as we can, so that the shared context is that much greater, so that the people will see themselves in the spirit of that collective and want to be part of it, because it's really speaking to the thing that they're caring about and working on. And then it also really helps to advance the conversation and advance then also the identification of what can we do together, because, you know, we're not trying to boil the ocean. We're really looking at a particular slice.
Got it. Thank you for that. I think that you addressed one of the biggest parts of my question, which was the natural resistance in the system to even being part of a question, you know, a discussion around climate change, when there are actors that in the system that are heavily embedded in something that is contributing dramatically to climate change, and having them be part of that conversation. I think that's maybe one of the biggest challenges that I see, but I think you've expressed some really great ideas around how to do that kind of engagement. One of the things that I really liked, and it created this kind of mental picture for me, with also the help of the visuals that you have in the book, of course. But it's this idea of infusing energy into the network. Like I've been in tech my whole career, so when I think of network, I think of a networked world via the internet, via, you know, TCP/IP protocols and all that stuff. The way we plug in to each other, and there's energy there. There's real energy when that kind of plugging in happens, like enabling internet connectivity in a previously, you know, isolated community that now can participate in things that they hadn't previously. What was sort of where I went with that. But you bring in this notion of weaving. And so I kind of wonder if this is less about hardwiring and more a weaving metaphor that you would encourage.
Yeah, I think I love the term network weaving. This is from June Holly, at least as far as I know, and mentor of mine. She introduced the concept of weaving in terms of we're not building networks, like they're not structures like a bridge, but we're really kind of cultivating these interconnected ecosystems, right? And we can, one of the key leadership roles in that work is network weaving, which is connecting with individual people from across the system, understanding their needs and concerns and what they're working on, et cetera, and then also connecting people together, you know, weaving the threads that tie us together, weaving relationships between the network. You mentioned infusing energy into the network too. One of the things that really speaks to is in convenings or in these moments where we bring people together, it's not just another meeting, right? We're not going through Robert's Rules of Order, and we're not just, you know, going down the agenda list, A, B, C, all sterile and everything. It's really, again, let's bring it back to kind of community and connection and finding the fire in between us that we're drawn to, and sensing into it the energy, where it is, where it wants to go, kind of getting to that deeper level of human connection. And so infusing energy in that way is also kind of creating a different type of experience when people are brought together. That's not something that they're used to. And having conversations you don't normally have with people you don't normally have them with. That's, you know, in embracing, you know, head, heart, and hands, different approaches to the work, different ways of knowing and being. So infusing energy in that way is, it creates a different experience. And I also think of it, you know, in terms of like a visual, I see it as we're trying to build sort of a hot burning sun, something that draws people in, that creates this gravitational force that then kind of brings more planets and asteroids and other things into its solar system and constantly moving, constantly evolving. But we're really trying to create what's that hot burning sun, especially in convenings, those moments where people are brought together as many people as makes sense for the network at that time. But that creates an infusion of energy. And over time, energy dissipates. You know, people go back to their day-to-day lives. We get busy, et cetera. So that energy dissipates. We stay connected in some ways. But then we have those convenings again, and it brings people together again, and it creates this other spark of energy. So that's what I meant by infusing energy into the network.
Got it. And we move it around a little bit, and it's neither, you know, created nor destroyed.
Exactly. Yep. People just focus energy on different things, and that makes sense. But then we bring back to the kind of the collective.
Got it. Sort of in reference to Wheatley, you come up with your own term, pockets of possibility, and I really love that because I started to imagine again kind of these networks sort of running, sort of, you know, and supporting these systems or sort of helping to morph these systems. And then amongst these networks, these pockets of possibility. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. First of all, one of my all-time favorite Meg Wheatley quotes, "The world doesn't change one person at a time. It changes as networks of relationships form among people who discover they share a common cause and a vision for what's possible." And in one of her more recent books, she talked about creating islands of sanity. You know, we can't change the whole system all at once. If you try that, you're gonna burn out. It's just too hard. But what we can do is change individual smaller systems. We can change local systems. We can create these islands of sanity where people are really connecting differently and creating kind of a new ecosystem within a particular space. And I use the term pockets of possibility instead of islands of sanity. It's just maybe a little bit more hopeful, but it's just a different way of thinking about it. Less kind of reactionary to what's outside the island of insanity, which I resonate with that as well. But but I kind of think of it as, you know, planting seeds and kind of helping to cultivate a garden, because I see a lot of this work of building networks really is like cultivating gardens. You know, no two gardens are exactly the same. Every plant grows in relationship with its neighbors and the soil and the climate. We can't grow gardens overnight. It takes time for plants to develop. But what we can do is we can plant the seeds. We can provide the nutrients, the water, the sunlight. The plants need to grow and thrive. We can tend to these gardens. We can provide pollinators. We can even provide some degree of structure in the form of the stakes and trellises that plants grab onto as they grow, right? So we can't force plants to grow in a certain way, but we can support them as they grow with the scaffolding. And we also know if we impose our influence too much on nature, on gardens, we might mess things up, but we can cultivate them with care, and we can cultivate these networks with care without forcing them or controlling them. So in terms of pockets of possibility, it's kind of creating these fertile soil for new things to grow and then new flowers and fruit to bloom out of that.
As we wrap up here, just a couple of final things I'd love you to touch on. So creating systemic change is a marathon, not a sprint, you write. And in this section that you call planting sequoias, which I really like, and you did touch on this earlier, this longer term, we have to think of course, in terms of the longer term, maybe seven generations from now. But in terms of how you're sort of thinking about the impact, the ability to create new systems potentially, and the role of this kind of work and this kind of mindset, just talk a little bit about that.
Oh, well, that reminds me of the famous Buckminster Fuller quote, you know, you don't change things by fighting the existing system. You create a new system that makes the old one obsolete. And, you know, that actually has led me to work more in the Web3 space over the past year with DAOs, these decentralized autonomous organizations that it really is trying to create, you know, new systems, new local economies, rather than, you know, directly fighting against the existing system. And, when we're trying to change existing systems or create new systems, you know, this is, it's long-term work, of course. It's multiple generations. The planting sequoias was in a reference to Wendell Berry, you know, plant seeds of sequoias that you won't see to grow. And I think we have to hold that longer term vision, because it's so easy, at least speaking for myself, to be totally disheartened with the planet and the pace at which we're addressing, you know, climate issues and everything else. But, you know, we have to start somewhere, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. and back to Meg Wheatley, we can't change everything all at once. So where can we focus? You know, and for me, you know, we can focus locally. We can grow these pockets of possibility. We can cultivate these really vibrant gardens in our own place or around a particular issue. We can really connect people and organizations in a new way, so that the whatever system they're working within can be that much more healthy and vibrant. And through Web3, we can create some new tools and infrastructure that kind of allow people to coordinate at larger scales than we ever could before, to at scales beyond where we know each person and we have some degree of trust or understanding, but how do we actually create trustless systems where we can coordinate even when we don't know anything about each other? So it is a long game, but I think, you know, I've seen the transformation that happens in a single convening and in a single moment when you shift the nature of the conversation and when you bring people to a deeper level and a deeper level of shared understanding and human connection. And that change doesn't have to take a long time. that can be really almost instantaneous, and it can have really profound ripple effects. So we're holding that long-term vision, but we can also do really profound things, transformative things in a really short amount of time if we just choose to engage with them differently and be deliberate about the process, again, even though we might not know exactly what results are going to unfold.
Amazing. Oh, for sure. David, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation. I love the book. I love the work you're doing, and I hope we get a chance to speak again, and maybe we'll find a way to work together. So thank you for joining me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you. You've been listening to my conversation with David Ehrlichman about his 2021 book, Impact Networks, Create Connections, Spark Collaboration, and Catalyze Systemic Change. Thanks for listening. And until next time, so long.